This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is for Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo, case 259, Bajiao's question and answer. The main case. Master Bajiao of the Ying region was once asked by a student, "Master, please show me a way not to fall into conditions." Bajiao said, "When there is a question, there is an answer." The commentary. This visiting student wants to know if there's a way to meet situations without getting stuck. When Bajiao says, "When there's a question, there's an answer," he completes the case. Do you understand? Bajiao knows how to give what you have and take away what you don't have. If you want to know how to avoid falling into conditions, you first need to know that playing with a deadly snake is a matter for an adept. If you're grabbing at reflections, trying to reach the form, you haven't yet recognized that the form is the source of the reflection. If you're raising your voice, trying to stop an echo, you've not yet understood that the voice is the cause of the echo. In order to free that which is stuck and loosen that which is bound, it's necessary to cut away all the traces of thought and every remnant of the sound of words. This is called discerning the phrase outside of patterns. Dao Roshi's verse. Responsible for humanity, you can't defer. Much talk. Who knows that it leaks one's potential? Transcending patterns, leaving the clamor, spiritual work goes into action. So we're concluding introductory retreat this weekend, and the Buddha taught that all conditioned existence is dukkha. Dukkha means suffering, disappointment, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, a basic state of not being at peace. Conditioned has a particular meaning in Buddhism. It refers to the sankharas. And sankharas are the essentially pointing to all phenomenal reality, everything that you can experience with any of your senses, including your mind. Because each of those objects, everything, is dependent upon conditions to exist, to be. Whether it's a building or a human body or a cloud or a tree or a thought, that nothing exists on its own. Everything is a result of certain conditions being sufficient for that phenomena, that object to appear. And so every object is conditioned in that sense. Another meaning is that the mind that is has intention, that rises out of desire and acts on that intention, creates karma. And that's the basis of everything we are and do and know. And so in the teaching of dependent origination, which is part of the Buddha's enlightenment, that he said that he saw into this on the night of his enlightenment, that because of our delusion, our not understanding things as they are, our misapprehending things, seeing things in a way that appear true but are not true, that conditions, influences our sankharas, our mental formations, the seat of our creating of karma within our mind, and that conditions our consciousness. Our consciousness is dependent upon that. And that conditions our physical body, everything mental, everything physical that we call our body, our self. And then when that appears, then that conditions our six senses through which the world flows in and out. And that conditions how we come into contact with that world, which conditions the feelings, the sensation that we have when all of our, each of our senses comes into contact with the world. And that conditions how we respond with grasping. And then how that grasping becomes clinging. And how that clinging gives rise to a sense of self, me. And how that gives rise to a sense of having come into this life, of appearing in this moment. And that conditions what the Buddha called the whole mass of suffering, sickness, old age, death, sorrow, grief. And that in turn conditions our delusion. And that this cycle goes on and on and on, which is what we call samsara, until it's interrupted. And that the great enlightenment, the realization of the Buddha was that nothing exists on its own. Everything is impermanent. And it's because it's impermanent, all conditions, all things, that we suffer because we don't like that. And we try and make it different. So we basically fight reality in our mind, and that becomes our voice, it becomes our actions, it becomes our institutions, it becomes our everything. And so we see that fighting happening. It's so much of the story of human history, it's the story of today. And all the while, as Dadaroshi says, much talk. To explain, to rationalize, to justify. You know, I think of this when I turn on the news and I see so much talking about things that in a sense have to be seen and reported on, and yet all the while the house is on fire. And so this student is asking really the essential question. Everybody wants to know, how can I not fall into conditions? Given that this is true, that life has adversity. Having this physical body, being in this physical world, having desires, being sentient beings, we experience pain and pleasure. And so we have a sense of a life, a possible life that is free and unhindered. And we experience the moments of life that are painful. And so this student is saying, how do I not fall into conditions such that that my life is in a constant state of conflict, of grasping? And so the Buddha realized we have to go to the source, the heart of the matter. Right? It's because it's so easy to get caught up in just the symptoms. And the symptoms are not separate from the heart of the matter, but it's a little bit like a fire. If you just keep, you know, splashing a little bit of water around the edges, you never get to the source. Please show me a way not to fall into conditions. Dadaroshi's footnote says, it's too late. You're already nostril deep in it. Not just this student, but everyone is already nostril deep in it. In a sense, it is the human state because we live in this world. Everything, the Buddha realized, is conditioned. And that's not a problem. It's not a mistake. It's the way things are. It's how we understand it. That's why the dependent origination begins with ignorance, with delusion, not understanding. Or having an understanding that is not in alignment with what is true. Is there a way to non-hindrance, to a life, to living this life without creating suffering? Right? It's not realistic to think that we can be in a world in which we never feel or experience difficulties. The Buddha, just like the rest of us, got old. He got sick at times. He had back aches. But is there a way to experience life in this body, in this physical world, without creating suffering? Because there's no other way that it appears except for our creation. Is there a way to meet and alleviate suffering within us and all around us without becoming that very thing we're trying to alleviate? Is there a way to meet hatred without becoming the hatred? To meet violence without taking up violence? To be in the midst of differences without creating divisions and dualities? As Dr. Roshi says, is there a way to meet situations without getting stuck? A student once asked Master Bajau at another time, what is it when one has a question but doesn't speak? Bajau says, without leaving the monastery, you take a 1,000-mile journey. And so the question may arise within us, some inkling of discontent or of not quite believing the story that we've been raised, each of us, to believe and absorb and play out again. Not quite believing that, but if we don't speak, if we don't respond, if we don't act on that, then Bajau says, without leaving your place, you'll take a 1,000-mile journey. It's going to be a long trip. And that question, unresponded to, lies fallow. And eventually, it's as though it begins to decay and drop away. We forget. I can't say how many times folks have come in during a retreat like this, in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and said, when I was a young person, I encountered the Dharma, and it felt very important to me, and I started to practice, but then I had to get on with my life. I had to deal with the realities of my life. Even for one in a monastery, this can happen. You know, being somewhere, even if the conditions are quite good, can't make us into a practitioner. Can't make us want to understand. Can't make us respond to that question. That has to come from within. Shantideva, the old Indian master, spoke of the arising of bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind, the mind that seeks a path of peace and unity. But then there's adopting bodhicitta. And so we can sit on our couch and raise bodhi mind and never get off the couch. So adopting bodhicitta says practicing means to practice bodhicitta. The student in the question, this student asking this question, please show me a way not to fall into conditions, is only able to ask that question because on some level, without knowing anything about them, but simply because they're standing before this master asking this question, we can know that they, in some way, have recognized that they are stuck. That being stuck is causing them pain. They are in some level in contact with their discontent. And that they have some faith that there is something more. They don't have to just reconcile themselves to that sad truth. And that they have traveled. They have sought. They have a question and they are trying to answer it. They have done what each of us has to do. Master Dogen said, once you hear or see the true teaching, you should then practice it. Sometimes we can get so enamored. We hear a teaching, we encounter the Dharma and feel so much resonance, we can just sort of bask in that resonance. As though something is happening. And something is happening. But a seed of something is happening. He goes on to say, one phrase offered by a loyal advisor can have the power to alter the course of a country. One word given by a Buddha ancestor can turn people's minds. The unwise ruler does not adopt the advisor's advice. If you don't step forward, you cannot encounter the Buddha's teaching. If we are unbending, we cannot stop floating along in the endless cycle of birth and death. If appropriate advice is not heeded, governing with virtue cannot be realized. Attending, raising bodhicitta, and adopting bodhicitta. And so this student says, show me that way. Show me that way to not fall into conditions, to be free of this cycle. And the fact that they're nostril deep in it can sound like a criticism. It's not. It's just the truth of it. Because asking that question, being nostril deep in it, the door opens. The door is opening. They are in the midst of their conditions, and they are using those to discover how not to fall. And that's such an important aspect of Buddhist practice, Buddha Dharma. Don't waste anything. You know, our dualistic mind, our choosing and rejecting mind, you know, is constantly, when we chant the identity of relative and absolute, do not judge by any standards. That doesn't mean not to recognize good and evil, to not see what is right and what is wrong. It means that we all have these internal standards by which we're constantly judging whether something is worthy or unworthy. Do I give this my attention? Do I blank out? Do I regard this or do I throw it away? And what the Buddha Dharma is teaching us is that everything has the value to show us how not to fall into that very thing. Our sadness, our grief, our fear, our quiet desperation. Right? I mean, none of us encounter the Dharma because everything is just going along swimmingly. It arises out of some unrest. But if we don't respond to it, if we don't respond to it skillfully, then that unrest tends to fester. It tends to be compounded. It tends to be shared widely with others. And so having the faith and the courage to seek, which requires, and it requires courage because we probably have some sense that there is going to be disruption, right? I mean, otherwise, don't do anything, right? It's not that there then is no disruption. It's just a familiar disruption. But the moment we take a step into a new direction, there is going to be disruption. And so there has to be courage. And that's why it's also important to make sure we're stepping into a path that is true, that is worthy. But to be able to do that means we have to step forward not knowing what's next. Even as we're scoping out and planning the whole thing. We should know that, no, that's just a fantasy. I don't know what happens next. You know, I've said to several people this weekend, this was not part of my original plan. Right? I had a plan. It wasn't this. And sometimes that scares people because it's as though the Dharma is, you know, like some big bully that's going to reach out while you're walking, you know, peacefully down, grab you and take you down some alley. You know, and force you to, you know, a life of service. Right? And awareness and compassion. It doesn't quite work that way. You know, to really appreciate how the depth to which this has to be given freely. Every moment. And yet, and at the same time, we don't know what that means. You know, we don't know where it's leading. And so we have to be willing to not know that if we want to take that journey and to have some sense that we have the capacity to do that and that to whatever degree we feel unable or not yet capable in this moment, that capacity, sometimes we're just wrong, we do have a capacity. And at other times, it's that capacity is going to develop. Right? We will gain that confidence. That's why practice happens one step at a time. So somebody encounters the Dharma, maybe they begin sitting, and they discover, oh, I can do that. And then maybe they come to a place like this, right? Which means leaving home and experiencing a certain amount of disruption of unfamiliar things, unfamiliar people, encountering things, practices, teachings we don't understand, and maybe being challenged by that. And then maybe we do Sesshin. I'm not sure I can do Sesshin. Nobody who does Sesshin for the first time knows that they can do it. They may believe they can do it, but they don't know that yet. And then they enter into it, and now they know they can do it. And so at each step along the way, that confidence is developing in real time. Every journey is like this. And perhaps that means that we have to be willing to fail, whatever that means to us. And Lord knows it means something to each of us. Right? We all have lots of ideas about what failure is. So whatever setting out on this path means, if there's hesitation because I might not succeed, you know, one good way of responding to that is just chuck that standard. Right? That sense of knowing what success and failure is, because it's not true. Another way is just allow, okay, I might fail. According to my rules, I might fail. Okay. So now that I've acknowledged that possibility, let's get on with it. The point is, don't be stopped. That's the point. You know, I remember when I'd left school, shifted my direction. I decided I wanted to pursue music professionally. I was applying to schools, and I was talking to a friend of mine who was a flutist at that time, which was my direction. And I was scared. And he said, look, right now you're standing on this side of the door. And you're trying to look through and imagine, and what you're seeing is, you know, not promising. He said, but when you step through that door, it's not going to be the same because you're going to be on the other side of the door. The world is going to appear differently to you. And he was right on the mark about that. And that didn't mean that I would realize every dream, that I would succeed at every ambition, but just that it will be different than anything I can imagine at this point, in this place. I was thinking of Greta Thunberg, this young Swedish woman who just started responding to her own imperative, going on school strike once a week. Do you think that she had any idea that she was going to initiate a movement that was going to spread around the whole world? That she had a plan? It's hard to imagine. Roshi says, responsible for humanity, you can't defer. Indeed. You know, in the beginning of practice, for most of us, it's usually very much about ourselves, our lives, our pain, our confusion, our questions. And that's a perfectly valid place to start. But in truth, it's because we are responsible. It's because we cannot defer. And if this time and place on planet Earth is not showing us that, we will communicate that, then we're never going to get it. The cost of deferring is time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. That's the cost. So is there a way not to fall into conditions, the student asks, and Bajiao says, when there is a question, there's an answer. Very simple. And that's what makes this an interesting koan. A koan is a moment of reality. This is just a simple dialogue between a student and a teacher. It sounds like an ordinary conversation. They're using ordinary words. Bajau responds in a way each of us can understand. Of course, when there's a question, there's likely an answer. Everybody understands that. And in understanding that, nothing happens. There's no change. And so the fact that this is a koan, that Master Dogen copied this and brought this back from China, that it was in a collection of teachings that he had available to him, that he wanted to be able to use, that Dada Roshi gave a talk on this, wrote a commentary and a verse, should raise a question, okay, what else is going on here then? There must be something else going on. When we ask a question in the ordinary sense, we're asking from a place, a perspective, a place of knowing. We generally already have some sense of a ballpark of an answer. How do we ask without knowing? What kind of question is that? Dada Roshi in the footnote says, unless there's a question, there can never be an answer. That other dialogue that I quoted of Bajau's is saying the same thing. That's why the question is so important. That's why this is a path of examination. If everything is fine and we have no concerns, if we're contented with the way the world is going, we're contented with the way our lives are going, and we have examined it deeply, then there isn't an issue. There is no question. But in asking within knowing, as important as that is, inevitably we're already moving away. We're moving away from that which we seek. But it's necessary. That's why Dada Roshi says, if we grab at reflections, trying to reach the form, the heart of the matter, the truth, we don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflections. It's like loving someone and wanting to reach them in intimacy. But our reflections, our fears, our projections, our attachments, our memories, past relationships, obstruct us. And so then the person that we see that we're trying to reach out to becomes obscured in our mind. And they become that very thing. It's like being in a It's like being downstairs in the dining hall at lunchtime. There are many of us. There's a lot of spirit in the room. People are having conversation. And it gets loud. It's hard to hear. So you speak louder. So what you can hear. They can hear you. You can hear them. And it gets louder. And so we have to speak louder. We don't realize that the din, the source of the din, is our own voice. That being afraid of losing what we want to possess, we cling, not knowing that in our clinging, that our clinging is the very source of losing. Dada Roshi says, in order to free that which is stuck and loosen that which is bound, to cut away all the traces of thought and the remnants of sounds of words. This is called discerning the phrase outside of patterns. And so there's much teaching about the patterns, the karmic patterns. And so it's like when rain falls, and it just falls on level ground. But the ground is not perfectly level, because it's alive, it's organic, it's the earth. And so the rain finds its way into little crevices, little cracks. And because the earth is not flat, it flows in the direction of the incline or decline. And more rain falls in. And then the next time it rained, the same thing happens, and that crack becomes a little broader, a little deeper. And then over weeks and months and years, it becomes a gully, and then it becomes a river. And the deeper and the broader it gives, it forms, the more force, the more water flows in it, and the more forceful that water is, the harder it is. So in the beginning, You know, it has no force at all. But over time, it's a mighty force. Mighty enough to drag us downstream. To seem to take us under. And so these patterns is so much of what's important for us to be seeing as we examine the self, study the mind. That's where the conditions, both the conditioning are creating karma and the objects of mind, internal and external, are so powerful, gain so much power. That's so much of, I mean, there really is no other struggle. That's what we struggle with. And we struggle mostly with struggling. If that's the hardest thing, it seems, to actually gain faith in it. It's not the thing, because that ties back into just the problem is there, right? That's why suppression seems like such a neat and tidy strategy, right? Just get rid of it. Put it, outsource it. Send it to China, you know? I mean, just out of sight, out of mind. Now I'm fine. And it's that mentality, it's that whole view that has to be upturned. And so when he says cut away all traces of thoughts and remnants, that's a practice, that's a process. And the mind is capable of that at every step along the way. And it has the capacity to be free of thought and remnant. And so the koan is to take us directly into the principle. That's why Dadaroshi says, when Bajau says, when there's a question, there's an answer, he completes the case. He's showing the whole thing right there. The Buddha, you know, one of the things that's so important, and it helped me to gain faith in the Buddha Dharma, was when I saw very early on the Buddha to say that one of the most important fetters, mental hindrances, obstructions, is the attachments to doctrines and rituals. And of course, since the time of the Buddha, we've created a few more doctrines and rituals than were true in the Buddha's time. Right? And we run the risk of turning this into, in a way that's not skillful, what we call a religion. And so the koan is to free us of that so that we can use it freely. And so in a sense, the koan provides, gives us a question which has no answer. There's not an answer in the way we think of an answer. You ask a question, you get an answer. The answer is like a determinate solution to a problem that needs to be fixed. The question in the koan is you. The answer is you. It's your mind. It's an experience. It's a direct seeing. The passing through of the koan is you yourself being free in that moment of history, of time and place, of concern, of accomplishment. To quote Hong Zhu, it's a flower awakening within this training garden in the mountains. A student once asked Master Dongshan, what is the proper questioning and answering? And Dongshan said, when it doesn't come from your mouth. In other words, ask when a student sits with the koan mu, and I say, how are you practicing it? And they say, I say the word mu. I say, no, that's not it. That's coming from your mouth. When the whole body and mind is the question. That is the practice of the koan. And so to sit with this koan, the student has to be the one who wants to be free of conditions. Not in a distant and abstract way. That has to be your head on fire. You yourself want to know with urgency. And then you are the person asking Bajau that question because you must know. And when Bajau says, when there is a question, there is an answer, you don't hear that with your thinking mind. Because you know already that's not going to resolve this. You've tried that. And so you hear it with the whole body and mind, and it gains entry. Because when we hear it with our thinking mind, subject and object is born. When there is a question, there is an answer. And so how do you ask a question without creating a subject, an answer, or a questioner? How do you ask the question without creating an object, the answer? The Buddha said, when this exists, that exists. When this comes into being, that comes into being. In a sense, all of practice and training, all of the teachings is in this. When this does not exist, that does not exist. When this does not appear, that does not appear. What is the source of our delusion, our suffering, our attachment, our conflict? How is it when no question and no answer arises? How is it for the one who is free of self and other, of inside and outside? And for someone who really cares about our life, about this world, that's one of the difficult things, I think, is to have that much trust that we can sit in this endo, sit on this seat, and let go that completely of the world. Because it can feel like turning our back, right? And I think part of that is because we don't value stopping. We don't value silence. We don't value this kind of examination where you don't end up with a product that you can sell or a product that you can be bought with, you know, that will make you more desirable in the market. We don't really value that. And not valuing it is just another way of saying we don't have much faith in it. And so part of the faith of practice is practicing enough to realize that's not what's going on. We can use Zazen in a way to turn away from, try and escape, but that's not Zazen. That's not Dharma. We begin to see that this is actually how we begin to make true contact, how we learn how to really care without being eaten alive. And becoming the thing that we're trying to resolve. So we practice letting go. And then we let go a little bit more and a little bit more until we let go of everything. And then we let go of letting go. Bajiao once said, if you have a staff, I'll give you one. If you don't have a staff, I'll take it away. Which is a most excellent koan. Dada Roshi is echoing that here when he says, Bajiao knows how to give what you have and take away what you don't have. In a sense, the heart of this koan is is pointing to the persistence and the sort of the pervasiveness of our inclination to grasp and to believe in that as a viable way. And of the subtleties of how our grasping manifests itself, and then how is that taken away? How do we release that? Because again, remember, it can only happen with your permission. Master Dogen said, be it known that for studying the way, the established means of examination is to pursue the way in seated meditation, taking the seat of the Buddha. The essential point that marks this investigation, the essential point that helps us to understand this is Buddha Dharma, is the understanding that there is a practice of a Buddha that does not seek to make a Buddha. And since the practice of a Buddha is not to make a Buddha, this is itself the realization of the koan. It is the realization of suffering and the liberation from suffering. This embodied Buddha does not make a Buddha. Here, the baskets and cages are broken. A seated Buddha does not interfere with making a Buddha. At just such a time, from 10,000 ages past, from the very beginning, we have the power to enter into Buddha, the enlightened mind, and to enter into Mara, the deluded mind, to enter into liberation, and to enter into confinement, to enter into peace, and to enter into conflict. We have that power. Walking forwards, walking backwards, its measure fills the ditches and moats. It is beyond measure. And what he's talking about is that which we all possess, Buddha nature. So that we can, as Dada Roshi says, transcend patterns, leave the clamor. What is the source of the clamor? You don't have to take a single step to know. Just stop. Turn the light around. Then spiritual work can go into action. No longer deferring our responsibility for humanity. This weekend, there, I feel like there have been many of you who have spoken very sincerely about the your own bodhicitta, not using those words necessarily, but your own seeking mind, which is a very precious thing. It's a very powerful thing. In a sense, it's the most important thing because that makes everything else possible. When that's not there, then we can be in the midst of all the medicine in the world, but it's not going to heal us. So that seeking mind, that yearning, should be nourished, protected, fed. And in the clamor inside and outside, it's easier for that to become dull, to become distant. And so part of having this time together, having a monastery, training together, and focusing on that, is to contact that within ourselves in a way that you know is that true and you know is real because you're experiencing it. And then to return to your own ditches and moats and continue practicing from within each of our respective lives. And to see that wax and wane, but then to continue practicing, to continue to return into those things that will nurture that. And in that way, it becomes more strong, more resilient, more constant. That's the way. It's always been like that. So I just encourage all of us, and it's true for all of us. That's what my life is. That's what I do every day. I don't just wake up and say, well, I'm just going to ride on something. Everything is impermanent. So whatever confidence or motivation or conviction we might have, that's impermanent. You can take refuge in it because it's true, but not because it's permanent. That's a wrong taking of refuge. And that it being impermanent is not a problem. It keeps us in dynamic contact, in close contact with that part of ourselves, with this life in a very alive way. So I'll end with a poem. Asking or not asking. Let's leave this aside for the moment. This early morning chill belongs to neither summer nor autumn. The first changing leaves have no concern. The season of peace is here. This ancient wisdom of air and sunlight and moisture and heat and cold and root and branch and leaf is in perfect harmony, understands without knowing, fulfills its journey. We are like that. We are like that.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.